Alaskans have a front row seat to climate change, and Alaska's Energy Desk is telling the stories of our changing state in a new podcast called The Big Thaw. This is season two of Midnight Oil, a podcast we started last year to tell stories about energy and the environment in our state. Today on Talk of Alaska, we're going behind the scenes with reporters who spent weeks and months going in-depth on the biggest climate change issues affecting Alaska.
Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
In Alaska, climate change is hard to ignore. With eroding coastlines, changing weather patterns, and unpredictable fisheries, it's all around us. And this year, Alaska's Energy Desk is telling just a few of those many stories in a podcast called The Big Thaw. I'm Annie Feit. I'm an editor and reporter for Alaska's Energy Desk and the podcast. And today on Talk of Alaska, we have three of the other reporters and editors here to discuss The Big Thaw. We're going to play segments of the episodes and talk about how the stories came together. So Jennifer Pemberton is joining us from Juneau. She went to Kaktovik to do an episode on the increasing number of polar bears that come to town. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
And Liz Ruskin is in Anchorage right now, but usually in Washington, D.C. Liz did an episode on Lisa Murkowski's position on climate change. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Annie. Good to be here.
And Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage is working on our last episode on how oil companies in Alaska and around the world are confronting climate change. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hey.
And we want to hear from you, too. What's your view of climate change in Alaska? Is there a climate change story you think we should cover? If you've heard the podcast, you have a question on one of the episodes. Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, dial 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And then, of course, download our podcast. Like I said, it's called The Big Thaw. You can search Midnight Oil, The Big Thaw, wherever you get your podcasts. And Jennifer, let's start with talking about why we made this podcast. Can you discuss how The Big Thaw came about?
Yeah, well, I guess we should just say that we made a podcast last summer called Midnight Oil, the first season of it, and we had a lot of fun with that. And so that's part of why we decided to do another one. A lot of people asked us to sort of do another season of Midnight Oil, and we were like, what would that be about? Because the first one covered Alaska's 40-year history with the oil, and it's not like we were going to do, you know, the 41st anniversary of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And in the last episode of the first season, we kind of explored what the future of Alaska might look like with or without oil. And so in some ways, the new season picks up from there. Basically, you know, where has this oil history left us? We know that burning fossil fuels is changing the climate, but our economy and our way of life here in Alaska depends on us burning fossil fuels. And so the new episodes are about that conundrum, I guess.
And Liz or Elizabeth, anything you want to add to that? No?
I mean, I guess I would add that, you know, I worked on that last episode, and we mentioned climate change. We're like, this is a thing, by the way. But it was really kind of an asterisk, and that always sort of felt insufficient to a lot of us, it being such a big issue. So I think it was sort of a natural continuation of what we did last year.
Yeah, and one other thing I think listeners may want to know is how we decided on what issues. Of course, there's so many issues with climate change. How do you decide on just five to delve into? Jennifer, do you want to address that?
Yeah. I mean, we know that some people's eyes roll when they hear the term climate change and they're, you know, worried. We do in our regular lives at the Energy Desk, we do a lot of sort of wonky stories, you know, oil tax credits and policy stories. And so we decided early on that we didn't want to kind of get into the science of climate change or like deep policy stuff. We just wanted to focus on people whose lives are being impacted by climate change in real, tangible ways, like right now. And so that was sort of our criteria. It was like every story had to have, you know, a person or people, normal people in normal Alaskans. And then we also wanted to have stories from all around the state, since we know that climate change is impacting, you know, everywhere. And obviously the Arctic seems like the obvious choice. But, you know, we also found someone in the Gulf of Alaska, for instance, a guy whose entire industry that got wiped out by the blob.
Yeah, and that was a story I found because I kept hearing about the huge decline in the cod population in the Gulf of Alaska, an 80% decline. And that was tied to the blob, and then the blob was tied to climate change. And it's really one of the first times in my many years, more than a decade of reporting on climate change in Alaska, that I heard a direct link from climate change to the fishing industry. So I went to Kodiak and talked to a bunch of fishermen and convinced Darius Kasperzak, who's a jig fisherman, to take me out on his boat. And the cod decline has just had an enormous impact on him personally, and then also the whole town of Kodiak. So that ended up being episode 3, which is out now. But Liz, I want to back up and talk about episode 2, The Senator, which is your episode. It's about Lisa Murkowski and the tricky line she walks as a Republican who accepts climate science but doesn't take action to regulate greenhouse gases. Where did the idea for the episode come from?
It came from our colleague Rachel Waldholz, who said that, you know, I didn't really think I had so much of a part of this series because it was about, you know, Alaskans dealing with climate change on the ground, a lot of it. But Rachel said, no, I want a profile of Lisa Murkowski through the lens of climate change. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. And it gave me a chance to get out a lot of thoughts and observations that I had about Senator Murkowski that I, you know, hadn't found a home in other stories. And I was able to put them in this profile, which was, you know, kind of satisfying.
And what were the biggest surprises you had in reporting this?
I was surprised, you know, okay, so she is very outspoken in acknowledging the effects of climate change in Alaska, and she doesn't shy away from saying that it's, you know, man-made climate change that is affecting Alaska and the rest of the world. And she's been very outspoken on that. And so to many Alaskans who want to see climate action, she's kind of a hero for saying those things. And one of the surprising things to me was talking to some of the climate activists or groups like League of Conservation Voters, and how much they saw her as not helping and not supporting the policies that they think would make a difference, and actively fighting against some of them.
Yeah. Well, we can't play the entire episode on this show, but we do have a short piece of it for listeners today. Can you set it up for us?
Yeah, I think the point here, I mean, I wanted to point out that climate change is like abortion and healthcare, one of these issues where Senator Murkowski is to the left of the Republican Party, she's one of the few Republicans in Congress who willingly brings up the subject. And so we looked a little bit at the history of Republicans and climate change. The issue wasn't always so partisan. There's this goofy ad from 2008. Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich are sitting outside on a love seat in front of the Capitol.
We don't always see eye to eye, do we, Newt?
No, but we do agree our country must take action to address climate change.
It wasn't just Gingrich. Back in the mid-2000s, Republican senators like Richard Lugar and Lindsey Graham called for climate action. John McCain made it part of his 2008 campaign for the White House.
John McCain stood up to the president and sounded the alarm on global warming.
In 2009, it seemed like a bill to limit greenhouse gas emissions had a real chance. That summer, the Democratic-controlled House passed a cap-and-trade bill. That's where the government would put a limit on greenhouse gas emissions and let industries buy and sell the rights to send CO2 into the atmosphere, with the idea that if it costs money to emit, companies would cut back. A bipartisan group in the Senate was working on a compromise version, and Murkowski must have seemed like a natural to join their efforts. For years, she'd called climate change a problem. She acknowledged Alaskans were already seeing the effects, and she called reducing carbon emissions the right thing to do. But she wasn't on board. 2 years prior, she had sponsored a bill that included limited cap and trade, but now she had a different emphasis.
When we talk about what we're going to be doing to reduce our emissions, we also need to be stressing our energy independence in this nation.
And the key to energy independence, she said, is increasing domestic oil and gas production, along with renewables and nuclear power. A reporter tried to pin her down in a 2009 C-SPAN interview. What if a bill expanded nuclear power, offshore drilling, and renewables, and capped carbon emissions?
Would you vote for it?
It depends how the cap and trade piece is structured, because
She wouldn't be pinned down. Murkowski does passionately support money for energy innovation. But what she has always resisted is a tax on fossil fuels or any regulation of carbon that she says would damage the American economy.
We're not just going to be able to shut the whole thing down and say, well, this is what we have to do in order to save the planet.
In other words, her climate solutions are all carrot, no stick. And really, who likes sticks? Murkowski says raising the cost of energy would hit especially hard in Alaska, where fuel and power prices are already in the stratosphere. In the end, the 2009 cap-and-trade bill fizzled in the Senate. And in the decade since, no carbon regulation bill has gotten anywhere near the finish line. And Murkowski hasn't pressed for one. In fact, when Obama's EPA moved to regulate carbon, she led a charge to defeat it.
It's pretty clearly, for a decade now, just been talk.
Joe Rome writes a climate blog. He's a former Deputy Secretary of Energy from the Clinton administration. He says Murkowski's carrots-only approach is not a solution because it's too slow to prevent catastrophic warming.
And every time she's had a chance to actually take some serious action to deal with climate change, she has either done nothing or been an outright opponent.
Rome says Murkowski seems to be following an old Republican playbook.
The way to sound like you care about the climate but don't have to do anything is to say that the solution is innovation and not regulations. And the problem is climate change is an existential threat.
He says if limiting or taxing greenhouse gases would hurt the economy, letting the planet warm out of control is even more expensive, with all the wildfires, storms, and real estate loss to the sea. In other words, Rome says climate change is an issue where extreme moderation won't do. What we need, he says, is real action. And to him, that means limiting greenhouse gas emissions. I talked to Senator Murkowski often, but couldn't get her to sit down for an interview on climate change. I'm not really sure why. But I did have a colleague find her at an oil and gas conference in Anchorage and ask her whether she might support cap and trade again, or any policy that seeks to put a price on carbon. Murkowski says a national policy raising the cost of energy would be bad for people in Alaska villages, like the struggling mom she met who already pays a fortune for heating oil.
I can't go back to her and say, for purposes of a national policy, I'm sorry, we're going to have to increase what you are paying.
She didn't exactly say no, but bottom line, Murkowski isn't pushing to regulate or tax CO2. So if that's how you define taking action on climate, no, she does not support it. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
So Liz, that was the short version of your episode. What's in the full version that we didn't hear?
The full version really explores the roots of her moderation. And Murkowski being a moderate, I mean, it's hard to even convey how a, how rare that is in Washington. Things are so polarized. And for her to be a centrist is really a rare thing. I looked at her, at the roots of her moderation, and what keeps her in the middle there.
Yeah, and we have a caller now I want to go to. Kay in Juneau. Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, thanks for the show. I think it's really important. I've lived in Alaska for over 50 years. I came here in 1965, so I've been here through, you know, the discovery of oil on the North Slope and the whole thing. Lisa Rutkowski is beholden to the oil industry, and in my view, she has never taken an educational approach in helping people really in Alaska really understand the critical nature of climate change, the crisis that we're actually in. She's really offered no leadership at all on the issue of climate change. I've written to her so many times about things that were happening in our world, the evidence that we have of what is happening on the planet as a result of climate change. And she sends me these long, disingenuous letters about, you know, their efforts that she has her staff complete to apparently try to pacify people like me who were really, really concerned about the existential crisis that we're in. And, yes, she's a moderate. I mean, she's not as bad as Jim Inhofe or even Dan Sullivan, who continues to deny climate change. But she also denied climate change for a long, long time. Now she's saying it's real. But when she says it, I mean, I have a really hard time hearing anything there except just this sort of empty acknowledgement. So I really appreciate the fact that you have done this investigation up to this point. And what really needs to happen is she really, you know, this will not come from her or from any of these other political people in Washington, D.C. It's coming from the citizens in the United States who are actually going to be the people who lead us to solutions that really work to help us if we have time, enough time, to deal with the problem of climate change. And one of the things that we absolutely must do is limit the amount of fossil fuel burning that we're doing. And it's already happening in the Arctic anyway. I mean, the people in the Arctic and subarctic are actually seeking alternative forms of energy. It's just that it can't happen fast enough.
Okay, Kay, let me get a response from Liz here. Liz Ruskin, our reporter.
Well, I think Kay's point really illustrates the problem with being a moderate. Now, being a moderate is you might please half the people half the time, or please a lot of people some of the time, a little bit, or you really tick off both sides of a debate, and climate change is a perfect example of that. I mean, for people like Kay who really do want to see some serious action, you know, they don't see Murkowski as in the middle on this issue. They see her as really hardly better in their views than the people who don't believe in climate change. So, yeah, there is that perspective out there. And then from the right, she also gets attacked for you know, going against the party line. So, yeah, I think Kay's point really illustrates some of the dangers of being a moderate and a centrist.
We have another caller, Jim, calling from Juneau. Hello, you're on Talk of Alaska. Jim?
Good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I would hope that at least a number of people like you, far younger than me, get a chance to engage in this kind of conversation. It's clear that, to me, that Homo sapiens are just now realizing that they could destroy the planet. And interesting enough, it's coming with the primary energy source, or at least the one we've been using. On the other hand, when we've engaged in other national or international catastrophes, we've seen responses from leaders. I think it was Liz Ruskin mentioned, you know, Dick Lugar out of Indiana and John McCain and others at one time were recognizing that we really have impacts of climate change, and certainly in Alaska, people now are feeling it, recognizing it, and as you mentioned, even Senator Murkowski now openly admits that it's human caused, or at best radically exacerbated by our consumption of hydrocarbon, and though we're 4.7% or whatever the world's population, we are producing more than 25% of the carbon. And yet, and I think you also mentioned this, it really is political fear, particularly with, let me be kind, the person in the White House who now has let people be known that it's war with him. If you recognize climate, so you have people like Dan Sullivan and others who dare not cross this new political movement, Trumpism. So even in Alaska, and I will say this, the governor took him a little while, but he did appoint a climate leadership group. They're moving forward. But the real question to me, I'll just get to a punchline here. The government hasn't changed. We're still using antiquated government approaches to one of the most serious problems facing the planet, facing the nation, and certainly facing Alaska. But until we see a leader, a level of leadership, a high-level commissioner or secretary whose responsibility it is to deal with climate, I think it will reflect a very simple, at least in my experience, very simple big ape response, which is just fear. And I think most politicians, they are afraid to deal with the reality.
Okay.
Fight the planet for their political fear.
Great. Thanks, Jim, for that call.
Hi, Jim.
Do you have a response, Liz?
No, I just thought with the passing of Senator McCain, it is interesting to note that he was an advocate for climate change and then, for climate change action. And he, after losing the White House, he really changed and he backed away from it. And the last big opportunity to do something about climate, he wasn't on board either. It had been McCain and Lieberman who had, pressed for climate action in the Senate for a while. And then when it came down to this bill that the bipartisan group of senators was trying to put together in, I believe it was 2009-10, McCain didn't support it.
Yeah, that was one thing that I found really surprising about your episode was how much support, even from Newt Gingrich, Republicans had for climate action back in, was it 2006?
I think that's when, I actually can't remember when that tape was, but I have to say that it was a really good day, the day I found that tape of Newt Gingrich and Nancy Pelosi sitting, they're sitting on what looks to be a white leather love seat in front of the Capitol. And for some reason, it seems to be raining. Why anyone would bring a love seat out in the rain in front of the Capitol? Why did they have to be sitting on the love seat? I don't know, but it was beautiful tape and I loved it.
It was. Lisa Murkowski is in your episode, but she did not agree to an interview for the story. Why do you think that is?
You know, I don't know. I think we get along pretty well. I have talked to her, regularly, and I think first of all, there's not a lot of upside for a politician discussing climate change. There's a lot of downside. I think that she wants to discuss the issue. She wants to frame it in the way that she wants to frame it. And she, you know, didn't care to do that interview. So I relied on archival tape. I mean, there was, you know, a fair amount of tape of her talking about climate change, and that was useful.
We have one more question from somebody emailing in. They say, Tom in Fairbanks says, Liz, did you point out to Murkowski that a carbon tax would provide rebates to consumers that would cover higher costs? We were just saying you didn't actually talk to Murkowski.
Right.
Did you find her talking about that in any
No,
tape?
I did not find her talking about the specifics of a climate solution. She was critical of specific carbon tax solutions. There were specifics of those proposals that she didn't like, but I didn't see her discuss proposals that she did like.
And have you heard any reaction from Murkowski's office since this episode came out?
I haven't. I've heard from some of her former staffers, but I haven't heard from anyone from her office. And I think they might have their issues with it, but I think they figure if they chose not to participate, they should, you know, hold their tongues, is what I'm assuming, or else they just, you know, had no issue with it and loved every second of that podcast.
Sometimes no response is the best response, I found.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to take a quick break, but we'll hear more about the podcast, The Big Thaw, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Funding for Talk of Alaska was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit. Today we're talking about climate change in Alaska and the podcast, The Big Thaw. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call if you have a question about the series or an observation to make about what you're seeing with climate change in the state. You can call 1-800-478-8255. If you're calling from Anchorage, dial 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And of course, download the podcast. You can search Midnight Oil, The Big Thaw, and you will find it wherever you get your podcasts. We're now going to turn to episode 5 of our podcast. It will be our last episode, which means it's not out yet. I think September 6th is the release date, which is coming right up. And Elizabeth Harbaugh is responsible for this episode. It is called The Culprits. And just to start, Elizabeth, do you want to explain that title?
Yeah, I better if anybody in the oil industry is ever going to talk to me again. the point of calling it The Culprits, and it sort of digs into this idea that for a long time, the oil industry has been seen as one of my sources put it, the boogiest of the boogeymen when it comes to the climate change narrative. And in some ways, that makes a certain amount of sense. But also, there's a much deeper story there. Happening right now on how the oil industry is actually thinking and working on the issue of climate change. And it's not necessarily what people would expect.
So why was it important to do an episode on the oil industry?
Yeah, especially given that the whole first season of Midnight Oil was all about the oil industry. The oil industry is one of the biggest industries in the state. It operates in the Arctic. It should come as no surprise that they, too, are in some ways victims of climate change, even though they're generally seen as the culprits. And, you know, how the oil industry is going to think about climate change going forward may actually have impacts in Alaska, you know, down the road in ways that people might not be thinking as much about now. But if you look at how the really big oil companies are thinking about climate change, it's worth asking some questions on how they're going to look at Alaska in the future.
Okay. And like I said, the episode isn't quite ready yet, but you did do a short story that kind of gave us a window into how the oil industry is dealing with climate change. Do you want to set that up?
Sure. So Alaska's oil industry, as we know, they operate on the North Slope. This is the Arctic. They've done some really amazing engineering, actually, to adapt to working in Arctic conditions. But the Arctic is also warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. So it should come as no surprise that they're having to make some adjustments. And I found out that there's a couple businesses here in Anchorage that have actually found an opportunity in making those adjustments for the oil industry, that they kind of are starting to adapt to a warming world now. So, this is my profile of a couple of those businesses. A few steps outside his warehouse in Anchorage, Brian Shoemaker asks me to do a little pretending.
Imagine for a moment you've just landed in a helicopter out on the tundra, and you're about 100 miles from anywhere, and it's costing you $1 a second to be here. This is what we do.
We picture ourselves on the remote North Slope, near Alaska's biggest oil fields. There, every winter, companies build hundreds of miles of ice roads. Roads literally made of ice, essential for moving the massive equipment used for oil exploration. But oil companies aren't allowed to build ice roads until the fragile tundra is sufficiently frozen. And scientists say freeze-up is happening up to 2 months later than it did in the 1980s.
Okay, so we're gonna find a spot.
That is a huge drill.
Pretend that this is the center line of an ice road.
Shoemaker has developed technology that monitors when the ground freezes, pinpointing exactly when ice road season can begin. To demonstrate, he drills into the frozen soil and inserts a blue and yellow temperature monitoring cable. He hooks it up to a small solar paneled box. This sends temperature data to the internet via satellite. Using this device, Shoemaker says companies can squeeze the longest possible oil exploration season into steadily shrinking winters.
Usually with our technology, we can get folks out there days to weeks early. And so it translates into huge cost savings.
State regulators say Shoemaker's technology has actually helped lengthen ice road seasons in recent years. His startup is called Beaded Stream, and he isn't alone. Oil companies now help support a cottage industry of consultants and product manufacturers in Alaska, all providing workarounds for the fact that the frozen ground they rely on to produce oil isn't so frozen anymore. Although Shoemaker says when he talks to customers, he doesn't bring up why temperatures are rising.
I'm not debating what's happening. What are we going to do about it?
Multiple oil companies contacted for this story turned down interview requests. But climate change is so present in Alaska today that the industry's top lobbying group acknowledges it's creating problems. Josh Kindred is with the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
It is ironic, and it's challenging for a state that is so dependent on resource extraction, but is also really feeling the impacts of climate change.
For Kindred, the idea of stopping the state's oil production to address climate change is unthinkable.
It'll be interesting to see how we navigate this. I don't want to call it a conundrum, because I do think there's an opportunity for success here. But what is our role, and how do we do it? Those are very difficult questions.
Meanwhile, oil companies keep finding ways to adapt. Ed Yarmak runs a company called Arctic Foundations, which makes devices that literally refrigerate the ground. The company was founded in the 1970s. The oil industry has always had to incorporate special engineering to work around permafrost. But Yarmak says rising temperatures mean his product is really starting to come in handy.
To be honest, climate change is pretty good business for our company, because we're in the business of making things colder, and climate change is warming things up in Alaska.
On the North Slope, oil companies built a vast network of roads, pipelines, and buildings on top of permafrost. But permafrost temperatures in the Arctic have been rising for decades. Yarmak says thawing ground on the North Slope can start to cause problems.
The doors start to stick, the sheetrock cracks, the floor isn't level anymore. Things aren't the way that they planned them.
That's where Arctic Foundations comes in. In the company's Anchorage warehouse, guys in protective goggles are manufacturing thermosiphons, long metal tubes filled with a refrigerant. When they're finished, these are partially buried in the permafrost to keep it frozen. Yermek shows me the top part of a thermosiphon, which is covered with a dense array of tiny fins.
It's where the heat comes out and goes to the air.
Yermek says each is custom-made and can cost up to $10,000. Oil companies have installed thousands of them across Alaska's Arctic. If the state continues to warm as projected, he expects to be in business a long time to come. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
And Elizabeth Harbaugh is right here. Is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I should say Joshua Kindred, who I interviewed for the story, at the time he was working for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. That's the big oil lobbying group here in Alaska. He has since moved. He's now with the Department of Interior in Alaska.
Okay, and I want to talk more about your episode, but before we move on, I want to invite listeners to call in. You can call 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, dial 550-8422 or email us from anywhere at talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're open to questions on, this is like your chance to find out anything you want to know about the reporting process. We're available to ask. So give us a call. But Elizabeth, you spent a long time working to talk to leaders in the oil industry about the issue of climate change for this episode. How agreeable were they?
More agreeable than you might think, but it sort of depended on what I was asking about. The oil industry in Alaska will generally acknowledge that climate change is creating sort of issues for them, but individual companies, I didn't get any to like sort of speak to me on the record about what they're seeing. That's understandable. If you're a company, you don't want to talk about problems you're having necessarily, especially on an issue like climate change, which the oil industry just has so much baggage on. But when it came to talking about the much larger issue of climate change as a financial issue, about like the idea of carbon taxes on how it might affect their bottom line decades in the future, I did have some success for that. Oil companies are thinking about that and they are willing to talk about it.
And without giving too much away, what are they doing to confront the issue right now?
Well, spoiler alert, the world's biggest oil companies do believe in climate change. They acknowledge it's real. They acknowledge it's a problem. This shouldn't be too much of a surprise. They employ a lot of really smart scientists. They are now thinking of it as a financial issue, actually. They're having meetings. They're talking to investors about it. And that is a pretty important thing to acknowledge and look at. You even have an oil company in Norway right now. This year, they changed their name from Statoil to Equinor. They took oil out of their name. And there's sort of an interesting set of motivations behind that. But it is a change.
And in terms of oil companies as a whole, how big of a shift is how they're thinking about climate change from just a few years ago?
From just a few years ago, it is a shift. We're seeing, they're not, putting up a united front. Oil companies are all kind of reacting to this in a different way, in the ways that make sense for their businesses, which also makes sense. One important thing to keep in mind is natural gas is a big factor here. Natural gas is seen as a fuel that's lower carbon. It's natural gas power plants replacing coal plants. The oil and gas industry does see that as an opportunity. So they are thinking about that right now.
Okay. And we have a caller, Becky in Petersburg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to ditto the person that called in earlier from Juneau about Senator Murkowski and her intentions. I believe she's completely insincere in her concern regarding climate change. It's well known that the Tongass National Forest sequesters 8% of all the carbon stored in our national forest system. And she's a self-described child of the Tongass. Her and her dad's goal when he was senator and as governor have been to advance their personal philosophy of logging old growth, and when all the other national forests in the system have ceased this practice. And after the 2016 election, she was recorded on NPR holding a chair over her head while screaming, "I'm the chairman." because she was now the powerful chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. So I think what you need to do is follow the money, according to Open Secrets in the 2013-2014 election cycle. She placed 12th of 100 senators receiving over $335,000 from an energy and natural resources sector alone. And just 2 years later, in 2016, her campaign contributions from the energy and natural resources sector increased 368% to $1,234,000, placing her the second highest. That's number two of all senators.
And Liz, is that something?
I think that's where you can see where she's coming from.
Yeah, that is pretty typical for someone after they become chairman of Senate Energy and Natural Resources. And she does, know that she gets a lot of her support from oil and gas industries. She's never been shy about saying that she's in favor of seeing a healthy logging industry in the Tongass. I agree that a person should always look at the money.
Yeah. And Barbara is on the line from Gustavus. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, good morning. I just have a quick question. I'll take my answer offline. The question is related to the previous discussion. Do you think the ball has moved in Alaska for climate change enough that Lisa Murkowski may be vulnerable in the next election cycle?
Liz?
Is that a tough one? I guess, vulnerable to whom? I guess it depends who comes next. But I don't think, I could be wrong, but I don't think that climate change is the main issue that is deciding her election.
Yeah. You do talk in your episode how her extreme moderation, as you call it, does maybe make her vulnerable because there's only so many times you can appease one side and the other side and kind of keep everybody happy.
Right.
That's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, she definitely has to watch both sides of the fence. Obviously, we saw in 2010 she's vulnerable in a Republican primary to attack by the right. That does happen. She's also proven that she can get elected without the party. At least she did it once. I actually don't see climate change as being, the main issue that gets her elected or unelected.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break, but we'll hear more about the podcast as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station, Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Now we're going to turn to episode 4 of Midnight Oil, The Big Thaw. It's called The Visitors, which will be released this Thursday, which is coming right up. Our Juno editor, Jennifer Pemberton, is producing that episode. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
How's it going? Is it ready to go, or are you still working on some finishing touches?
That's a very boss question for you to ask. It is ready to go. So I was in Kaktovik reporting in June, and I spent most of July and August working on that story, and it's ready to go. It's like Christmas Eve right now.
Right. So describe the story that you're telling.
Okay. So I know we said no science, but we all know how sensitive polar bears are to climate change. They're losing the sea ice, which they depend on for hunting and living. I mean, they spend most of their lives, if not 100% of their lives, out on the sea ice. So as the sea ice melts, that is creating problems for them. But sort of in the short term in Kaktovik, that pressure is doing something a little bit different. At least for right now, in the area, it means there's actually more polar bears. So Kaktovik is this village on the coast of the Beaufort Sea, a little bit east of Dead Horse, sort of towards Canada. It's basically surrounded on all sides by the Arctic Refuge. So if you can sort of picture where that is. So it's this, you know, small town, 300 people. And the story is about what it's like to live in a town with more and more polar bears. And it's also about this kind of niche tourism industry that sprung up in Kaktovik because the bears are pretty consistently there in pretty high numbers. And people want to see them, both because, you know, they're really cool animals. I mean, they're definitely on my bucket list of wildlife to see in the wild. But also people express that they want to see them before they're gone, which could happen in our lifetimes. And so this is a fairly recent thing in Kaktovik, like in the last 10 or 15 years, that the bears have been coming to shore this reliably. And so, you know, 10 years ago or less, there were like maybe 50 people coming to see polar bears in Kaktovik, according to sort of ANWR staff there. Last year, there were more than 2,000 people. So that's actually a pretty big tourism boom in a town of that size.
Yeah, that is huge. And talk about why the polar bears are coming to Kaktovik.
Right. So like I said, polar bears live out on the sea ice, and they basically eat one food, which is something I didn't really know. I mean, they're scavengers and they'll eat all kinds of things. But in an ideal world, they eat ringed seals, like one kind of seal is the primary their primary diet. And so they're hunting these seals out on the ice, and the seals live in this kind of sweet spot, which is shallow seas that freeze over most of the year. But those are also the first places to melt. So every summer, around this time, actually in August, the bears kind of have a choice as the ice melts where they're hunting seals. They can go out, you know, head north to the North Pole towards deeper water where it's still frozen, but there's not as many seals there. Or they can head to shore when they are not adapted to living on shore, but they do it. And in Kaktovik specifically, there's this reliable source of food for those few months when they don't have ice, and that's this pile of whale bones and scraps. So the native community there hunts, they take 3 bowhead whales a year, and they use most of it, but the bones end up in this sort of bone pile outside of town, and the bears are very attracted to that. And I should say that it's a small percentage of the bear population that actually comes ashore. It's not something like the whole population is doing or anything, but the numbers are actually really impressive. I mean, there have been 80 bears there at a time.
Wow.
And, you know, these are bears that hang out by themselves if they're not breeding or have cubs. So it's a big deal to see that many bears in one place.
And, of course, you went to Kaktovik for the story. What was that like?
It was awesome. It was really, really cool getting to go to the Arctic and to go to someplace that far away and that different from my life. But I think I'm going to play an excerpt here of my episode that's going to help answer that question. It kind of starts with a description of the town. And then I end up jumping in the car with this guy who's a polar bear guide. He takes tourists out to see the polar bears, and he takes me out to the bone pile where maybe we'll get to see some bears.
Let me tell you a little bit about Kaktovik and why it's an unlikely vacation destination. It's less than 300 miles above the Arctic Circle. In mid-June, the sun's been up 24 hours a day for over a month, and it'll be that way until the end of July. Huge snowdrifts are melting and running downhill through the village to the sea. The houses are raised up on pilings. It's not more than a mile from one end of town to the other, but everyone has a truck or an ATV. There are a lot of animal parts lying around outside people's homes. Full curl ram horns, caribou hides, big drums of seal oil, strips of whale baleen. It's a little above freezing today, and you can smell all that stuff mixed in with the ocean breeze. It doesn't smell as bad as you'd think. The people here hunt for caribou and dall sheep. They fish for Arctic char. They eat seals and ducks and geese. and every fall, they harvest 3 bowhead whales. At the edge of town, there's a huge pile of bones where they dump the whale carcasses after the fall harvest. And that's one of the things that attracts bears to the area. There could be a bear at the bone pile right now, but I know better than to walk down there alone, so I hitch a ride with Bruce Englengesick. Bruce is a Nupiaq. He's a subsistence hunter and offers wildlife viewing tours, including polar bear tours, in the fall. He says he's seen a lot of changes since he moved to Kaktovik in 2000. Bigger storms, less sea ice, more polar bears.
What are we looking at here?
This is the Beaufort Sea. The dark spots you see right here, that's the Barnard Spit. And that's where we do our polar bear viewing, all on the inside right here.
Is that where the bone pile is?
No, the bone pile is at the end of the old airstrip over here.
We drive down the old runway, a narrow strip of land about as wide as a 4-lane highway. Even in June, the road is covered in so much snow, we can't get any closer than maybe a half mile.
I don't know how much further I can go.
Yeah. Can I take a picture of the bone pile?
Oh, yeah.
That's as close as we're going to get.
Yeah.
No bears.
Yeah, no bears. Yeah, we see them here year-round. All winter, we see them going east or west. Like I told you, they migrate along the coastline where the pressure ridges are. That's where the seals have their dens.
Right now, the bears can come and go from the sea ice to the bone pile as they please. But as summer progresses and turns to fall, the ice will be gone, and some bears will be kind of stranded near Kaktovik until the sea freezes again in October or November. And that's when tourists start coming to Kaktovik by the planeful. This bone pile is the best place in the United States to see polar bears. From far away, it looks like a shipwreck on the beach. But this fall, when the ice melts, people will be able to get up close in a boat, and there will be dozens of bears here. Giant males guzzling whale fat like they're chugging a beer. Females reclined in the sun nursing their cubs. Groups of 2 or 3-year-old adolescents scrumming over a piece of blubber in the ocean like they're playing water polo.
And Jennifer, how do people in town feel about having so many polar bear tourists?
Well, I'll say for the polar bear guides, which there are a handful of, it's great. It's a really great job, and they really enjoy doing it. They're very, you know, friendly people who like having guests and like educating people about the bears and what's going on with them. I did run into some people in Kaktovik who don't appreciate having strangers come to town. They don't like being sort of gawked at or sort of watched, especially when they're hunting, whale hunting, things like that. That was the main sort of downside, I would say, to having a bunch of people come around. And one other thing that sort of complicates this story is that, remember I said Kaktovik is located basically in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And with oil drilling and exploration happening there, there's going to be a lot more people coming to town. So I think in some ways that economy and that, you know, bring as far as like bringing people in could sort of dwarf polar bear tourism pretty quickly.
Right. That is a whole nother story. We have David on the line from Glacier Bay. Hello. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. And I have a kind of an observation to share. In the 1970s, Jimmy Carter was running the White House on solar and had massive tax incentives for future energies. And when Ronald Reagan got in, he took away those tax incentives and made people repay them. And in 1989-1990, I wrote the legalization of acupuncture through the Alaska legislature. And at the same time, I had about a one-page bullet point called Vision for Alaska Future. It was based on Alaska becoming the world's leading nation and or state in research and development of alternative or future energies. And we have all the solutions to heal this right now. And our tax dollars this year were wasted on $760 billion in a war package by the illustrious president. Imagine if that was invested in the conversion of of solar energy, wind, and biomass, which we can have a combination of. I run my house on Glacier Bay on solar year-round. We as citizens are so busy shopping and driving to make democracy work and let politicians continue in their myopic and cowardice and economic sycophants, the oil industry. My mantra at the moment to everyone is we destroyed it and we can heal it. And I use this metaphor that the Nazis are at the gate in the form of extreme weather events. And then I'm calling on the planet right now that we need a global D-Day where all the nations on this planet take the money out of their war machine, put in the infrastructure in place to heal this. And if I think we did that, we could, in 5 to 10 years, turn this whole thing around.
Okay, thanks, David, for that call. And I want to go to Kent now in Sitka. Hello, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, hi. Gee, David there goes right to the right to no skirting the issue. But my comment here is, you know, most economists agree that the failure of the market to account for the external costs of burning fossil fuels is, you know, the greatest market failure in history, and that we need to start accounting for those external costs by some sort of carbon pricing system. And if we start to account for the costs of the carbon emissions through carbon fees, we can begin to harness the market forces to help reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. And, you know, this has got to be a, you know, maybe the best first step to get us down the road that we need to go to reduce emissions. So it is so often assumed that greenhouse gas emission reductions will be bad for the economy, but really that is not true, and it's never, you know, in fact, there are proposals for taxation and dividend return that are actually good for economy, that grow jobs and GDP, and so we need to get away from believing that reducing, getting off of carbon is going to be bad for the economy, and investigate and implement ways that are actually going to be good for the environment. And so, you know, my comment with Lisa Murkowski is that she is really well positioned in Washington, D.C. to provide leadership in this debate, and to have her, you know, admit that it's happening and then not participate in the solution is just not acceptable.
Okay, Ken, thanks very much. I'll just mention that we have a few of the episodes do talk about a carbon tax. Dave Waldron was our engineer today. Wesley Early was on phones. Thanks for listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.